For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys.
Listen to Stories from the Pacific on your favorite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
In 1986, a young Marshallese teenager named Russell Langreen had just graduated high school in California.
It was tough trying to catch up from the standards in the islands.
It was the year the Compact of Free Association, or COFA, came into effect, an agreement that bound the Marshall Islands, the Federated States of Micronesia, and later Palau, to the United States. In exchange for U.S. military access and defense, the people of the Micronesian nations were granted the right to live and work and study in America and to enlist in its armed forces.
But I made it, and then I found out that we were able to join the military.
It opened a pathway many young islanders would take, often before fully realizing what it would cost.
I graduated in June. I joined up in August. I had no money for college.
At 18, Russell signed up, not for glory or adventure, but for a chance at education through the GI Bill, a policy that gave U.S. veterans access to education. Russell joined the Marines and was soon training at Guantanamo Bay.
You don't know English very well. You have to speak at the top of your lungs. And my job was minefield. And minefield was huge in Kuwait.
In 1990, Russell found himself in Saudi Arabia, part of Operation Desert Storm, a U.S.-led military campaign to drive Iraqi forces out of Kuwait after Saddam Hussein's invasion.
Allied bombers have been homing in on Iraq's heavy concrete bunkers, trying to destroy the rest of Saddam Hussein's air force.
It was the first major U.S. war since Vietnam, and he was a long way from home.
My thinking was, ooh, I'm going into war. Now we're not getting empty bullets. We're getting live rounds.
What unfolded in the Gulf was fast, overwhelming, and brutal. For weeks, coalition aircraft pounded Iraqi positions day and night, turning the desert sky orange with fire. When the ground assault began, armored columns smashed through trenches and minefields. Iraqi units were overrun in hours. Entire convoys were destroyed as they retreated, with the so-called Highway of Death littered with burnt-out vehicles and bodies. Tens of thousands of Iraqi soldiers were killed. And Russell was a Marshallese kid caught up in America's war machine.
And I was there, sitting in the desert thinking, what the heck am I doing here? I'm not cut out for this. I didn't join up to shoot somebody. I joined up for the GI Bill. It makes you grow up quickly.
After 4 years, Russell walked away from the Marines. He worked for a while in California, but eventually went home to the Marshall Islands. But when he got there, he realized something that stunned him. For all those years he'd served in America, back in the Marshall Islands, the U.S. had not established a support system. No veterans clinic, no one to help him deal with what he'd been through, just an empty space where care should have been.
PTSD for islanders, soldiers, or military veterans are really bad, and they have absolutely no help. No help or no counseling service, nothing that we can access that could help us.
Hi, I'm Scott Whitey, and this is Polytalk, where we take you behind the scenes of Pacific politics and how it shapes our lives. I'll speak to politicians from across the region and people living through their decisions. Today on Polytalk, decades after Marshall Islands and the Federated States of Micronesia and Palau signed their Compacts of Free Association with the U.S., we're asking the big question: has the deal truly worked for them? And what's been the real cost? This is part one of our look into the cost of COFA. For the Federated States of Micronesia, also called FSM, the Marshall Islands, and Palau, the relationship with the United States has never been just diplomatic. It's been lived, embodied, and for thousands of families carried in uniform. Under the Compacts of Free Association, these Pacific nations became some of the most loyal and dependable partners the U.S. military has ever had. Entire generations grew up with American recruiters walking into high schools, and for years, COFA states had the highest military enlistment rate per capita in the entire United States Armed Forces, more than anywhere in the 50 states, and more than any U.S. territory. Russell is now in his 60s, and the problems of illness that come with older age have caught up with him. But in the Marshall Islands, he can't get the veteran support services he needs. For decades, the Marshall Islands has asked Washington for help to send Veterans Affairs doctors to set up a visiting clinic or to even station a single counselor. But the Department of Veterans Affairs does not operate in the Marshall Islands, the Federated States of Micronesia, or Palau. And that's left thousands of COFA veterans stuck in a bureaucratic loophole, able to fight for America but unable to receive help from America unless they leave their own home. So Russell had no choice but to move back to the U.S.
I have a house right now in the state. As soon as I came here 4 years ago, I applied for VA housing and they gave it to me. When I applied on my own country for the same program, I didn't qualify there. Those are the things that we need to work on.
For him, the difference between living in America and living in the Marshall Islands is the difference between having care and having nothing. And the feeling of being forgotten runs deep.
I don't know what the VA is thinking, but, you know, out of sight, out of mind. They came in, they grab us, the cream of the crops, and then we get messed up.
In the Marshall Islands, PTSD looks different because there's no support system. No veterans clinic, no trauma counselor, no medication management. Veterans mostly try to manage on their own or collapse quietly.
A lot of guys have tried to come back, live a life, trying to work, trying to cope, trying to get back to the life that they'd known before. But they always have these things like, they don't understand me. That's why we hang out together, because we understand each other. We understand. If you go crazy, it's not going to bother me. Sometimes they couldn't find a job. Nobody wants to hire them.
Behind those stories are decades of political frustration. Congressional reports going back more than 20 years have warned that COFA veterans must often pay for their own airfare to just access Veterans Affairs care in Hawaii. Multiple bills have been introduced promising visiting VA staff or partnerships with local hospitals, but none were implemented. In 2023, the COFA agreement between the U.S. and Marshall Islands was renegotiated, and Washington pledged more than $2 billion U.S. dollars in funding to the Marshall Islands over 20 years. But not one line in those agreements created a VA clinic, a veteran center, or guaranteed in-country mental health care. For Russell, that omission is the heart of betrayal.
We have a very special relationship with the U.S., It's even named differently, Compact or Free Association. It's been 40 years. Why haven't we figured this out yet?
Now, decades after the COFA agreements came into effect and Russell headed off to war, he says all he wants is to be able to go home. But the system forces him to stay away from everything he loves.
I want to go back, but now I'm older, I got medical issues. Can't get it treated back there. Over here in Salem, I have a VA clinic that I can go to. They take care of you.
Even after Congress passed new legislation in 2024, allowing the VA to begin providing care in COFA nations, the rollout has been slow, and Marshallese veterans still haven't seen any permanent help.
You came in year one and recruited us. Now we're 40 years later. Something should have been done by now. This is how I feel. I want to go live back on my own island.
Russell isn't living in America by choice. He's there because of a system built decades, even centuries, before he picked up a rifle in the Marines. To understand how Russell ended up forced to live thousands of kilometers from his own island just to access the care he earned, we have to go back to where COFA began. and to the long history of how the Micronesian region was shaped by empires that claimed it, and how the United States never really let go. Before Kova, Marshall Islands, Palau, and FSM had survived centuries of colonization. First Spain, then Germany, then Japan as it expanded across the Pacific. And when World War II erupted, it became a frontline battlefield. The U.S. seized all three nations in a brutal island-hopping campaign, and when the war ended, America didn't leave. The United Nations handed the islands to America as part of the world's only strategic trust territory, a mandate that gave America sweeping control over the entire region. Land, airspace, borders, education, migration, and defense. So when Micronesian leaders eventually began negotiating for independence, they weren't negotiating from outside the U.S. system. They were negotiating from inside it.
So the compacts were established or elaborated at the time at which these former territories or colonies were becoming independent countries. So these compacts granted the U.S. strategic control over these nations' security and defense in exchange for economic and assistance and benefits for their citizens.
Emily Mitchell Eaton is a professor at Colgate University and the author of the book New Destinations of Empire Mobilities, Racial Geographies, and Citizenship in the Trans-Pacific United States. She explains that in the 1960s, Micronesian nations began pushing for independence from America, but the U.S. saw them as a vital Cold War security asset. For 20 years, leaders across the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, and Palau pushed for self-governance. And after endless rounds of talks, the U.S. response was the Compact of Free Association. But Professor Mitchell Eaton says COFA wasn't an equal bargain.
Negotiations between two countries that have a sort of a David and Goliath-like relationship. It's an incredibly uneven, unequal political relationship. So one member of this so-called partnership was a rising imperial superpower after World War II with a growing economic, political, and military influence of the U.S., and the other was its former colony.
And this power gap had devastating history behind it.
American officials discussed plans with the Pinckney natives for the evacuation of the atoll.
The Republic of the Marshall Islands had undergone massive U.S. nuclear testing following the end of World War II, right? The U.S. detonated 67 nuclear tests and bombs in the Marshall Islands over a number of years.
The islands weren't just strategic. They had been sacrificed. People were still dealing with cancers, contaminated food chains, and the trauma of being uprooted from ancestral land.
There also was, it's important to be said, a great deal of concern over the degree of autonomy that the island nations would have over certain areas of their governance, as well as the degree of influence the U.S. military would continue to have in the islands, including in places in the Marshall Islands that had been under nuclear testing.
And when they finally sat down at the table, the U.S. wasn't going to let go of its military holding.
Retaining exclusive military access to the islands was key. For the Micronesian negotiators, and I'm using Micronesia to refer broadly to that region of the Pacific, but that includes also the Republic of the Marshall Islands, the most important was the retention of unrestricted migration to the U.S.
So the deal became a trade. Strategic access for the U.S., migration opportunity for the Marshallese, and as Professor Mitchell Eaton puts it,
so the compacts really tie together migration and U.S. military access in a distinctly imperial fashion.
The first COFA agreements poured about $2.7 billion U.S. dollars into the Micronesian region to prop up its budget, to help with healthcare and infrastructure. But it also cemented U.S. strategic control.
The compact, I argue, reveals how colonialism changes and morphs over time. Empires use different strategies depending on what's effective or politically palatable or undesirable in certain moments, yet retains key features, namely dominance and restrictions on national sovereignty.
COFA quietly redirected the lives of tens of thousands of people. Those migration opportunities that negotiators traded across the table in the 1980s became one of the only ways many Marshallese families could chase safely healthcare and a steady income. And over time, those movements created whole new Marshallese worlds far from the atolls, in places like Springdale, Arkansas, a small city in the middle of the United States that's sometimes called the unofficial Marshallese capital. Benedict Kambua Madison is the executive director of the Marshallese Education Initiative, and his own story starts in Majuro and ends up in Springdale.
Yeah, so my family and I, we used to live in the Marshall Islands. So I was born in Majuro, the capital, and moved with my parents and siblings back in 2001. And we made Springdale, Arkansas our home for the last nearly 25 years now.
Benedict, why did your family decide to move to the U.S.?
So it was actually my mom who decided that we should move. This was due to the fact that our home was actually damaged by flooding in the early 2000s. And so it destroyed the interior of our home and a lot of our belongings. But also my dad was making $4 an hour working at the water company in the Marshall Islands. And so because of that and not being able to support a family of six or seven at the time, my parents decided that we should leave the Marshall Islands and head here to Arkansas.
And when you look back at the flooding that destroyed your home, do you see that as one of the early signs of climate change your family experienced?
I certainly would say so. And especially because of the damage that it left behind. I mean, we're talking about multiple homes being destroyed and water level coming up to about my father's waist. So it got pretty high, destroying anything in his path. But of course, nowadays, it's more intense and more frequent. And that is something that a lot of people back home are dealing with every year.
You moved to Springdale, Arkansas, which has been described as the unofficial Marshallese capital. From that perspective, how do you reflect on COFA and what it has meant for your community?
I think one word to describe it is dependency. You know, we were hoping to become self-sufficient under the Compact of Free Association, but that has become, we've become more dependent on the United States the last almost 40 years now. And obviously, there are a lot of issues that the compact does not address, including the ongoing nuclear legacy.
You've mentioned the gaps in what the compact addresses. Can you talk more about the nuclear legacy and what remains unresolved?
We have to look at the fact that the compact was initially signed in 1986 based off of information about the nuclear legacy at the time. But it wasn't until the 1990s when the Clinton administration declassified documents pertaining to the nuclear legacy.
The story is now emerging of a U.S. cover-up after a nuclear test gone wrong in the Pacific. The blunder occurred in 1954 as part of the American testing program in the Marshall Islands. Scientists exploded a bomb 1,000 times more powerful than the one dropped on Hiroshima, but miscalculated the fallout.
And so what we know now, we have a lot more information now in terms of the nuclear legacy than our elders and ancestors did prior to signing the Compact of Free Association. And so what we're actually wanting the United States to do is to release all of these classified documents without redaction so that we can better understand the nuclear legacy, we can better understand the bigger picture, and then to determine, okay, this is how much support we should be receiving. I always saw the compact as a cheap price to pay for U.S. nuclear testing in the Marshall Islands. We need adequate victims assistance and environmental remediation from the United States to address these ongoing issues that the Marshall Islands alone cannot address. And so if we have these resources available, then we should be able to, in the future, develop our country in a way where we don't have to continue to see people migrate to the United States to look for employment, to look for world-class health, healthcare, and education, so on and so forth.
Before COFA, the U.S. had obligations under the Trust Territory Agreement. How do you see that history shaping that relationship today?
These things should already be in the Marshall Islands. because prior to the Compact Free Association, there was the TTO, the Trust Territory of the Pacific Islands Agreement. This was between the United Nations and the United States, signed in 1947. And part of the stipulations were that the United States was supposed to develop the country and look after the well-being of the Marshallese people. But instead of doing that, they were busy conducting nuclear weapons tests, spending billions of dollars on that program instead of trying to help us develop our country. Instead, it was destroying the country and along the way, destroying people's health, displacing communities, and creating this dependency that we continue to see today.
Marshallese communities today experience some of the highest rates of chronic illness. How does the impact of the nuclear testing connect to that?
So I think it's important to note that, you know, earlier on, for centuries, you know, Marshallese depended on food that was grown on the land or from the ocean. And so food was healthy and fresh. And so with the nuclear testing program, the destruction of land and the displacement of people, that contributed to people having to depend on food that's imported from the United States and elsewhere. And so food such as canned food, ramen, rice, so on and so forth, food that doctors are now telling us not to eat because it's contributing to diabetes, heart disease, hypertension, and other chronic illnesses that we often say are nuclear related because of that history. I used to work at a clinic that served the Marshallese, and we had about 300 Marshallese patients with diabetes just here in Arkansas. And so that can give you somewhat of a picture to say that, you know, diabetes is a huge problem in the Marshallese community.
Access to Medicaid, the U.S. public health system, became one of the biggest fights for the Marshallese diaspora. How did that battle unfold over those 25 years?
I believe 1996, when these reforms were made by Congress under the Clinton administration, and Marshallese were kicked off, including other COFA citizens, Palau and Federated States of Micronesia. And it took nearly 25 years to have that restored. The United States knew that they conducted these weapons on the Marshall Islands and the health issues that comes from these destruction and not being able to do anything about it for nearly 25 years was outrageous. And it was in 2019, I joined other Marshallese from across the country to advocate for the restoration of Medicaid for Marshallese. Now, this was 2019, and then the year after that was COVID. And so that became a wake-up call. And so because of that experience, the United States Congress restored Medicaid later that year in 2020. And so Marshallese across the country were eligible for Medicaid. However, that's just eligibility. But when it comes to access, that's another issue because each state have requirements that we need to meet. You know, one of them being household income. You know, how much does a household make in a year? And so if you make a certain amount that's well within the state and the federal requirement, then you are able to receive Medicaid. But if you're not, then you can't receive Medicaid.
After everything your community has endured, how do you personally feel about the level of healthcare access the U.S. provides today?
Considering what they did to the Marshall Islands and forcing us to be, you know, experimented on, you know, we should have access to the best healthcare on the planet, probably the same as the president of the United States, simply because of the forced sacrifices that we've been through and that we continue to deal with to this day.
Despite the challenges, what do you see as the key benefits COFA provides for Marshallese families living in the U.S.?
I think in the current political climate, the fact that we have this separate agreement that's different than any other agreements that exist between other countries and the U.S. You know, the ability to continue to live here in the United States, and for some to be able to get some of these benefits, I think that's the, I guess, positive side. But as I mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of these things that we're seeking here in the U.S., we should already have these things in the Marshall Islands.
Speaking of the political climate, during the Trump administration, ICE, the U.S. federal agency that enforces immigration laws, has increased its activity dramatically. How has that impacted the Marshallese community?
Shortly after his executive orders, we saw an uptick of ICE raids in the Marshallese community. And we actually were contacted by the Marshall Islands consulate. And so that first week, we assisted about 800 Marshallese at the Marshall Islands consulate. I think 19 or 20 Marshallese were deported on U.S. military planes back to the Marshall Islands.
How did people feel watching this play out?
Scared. You know, we're talking about police vehicles on every street. One Marshallese woman who was approached by ICE knocked at her door asking for her husband. She said, well, he's sleeping on the couch. They walked in without any notices, got the husband, pulled him out. And we're talking about guns. We're talking about guys with, you know, guns, rifle guns, and black SUVs. And so you can imagine what's going on in the wife's head. Like, who are these people? Why are they taking my husband? Why are they coming in with guns, with, you know, unmarked SUV vehicles? And so we had to explain all of this to government officials of the Marshall Islands, and they too were shocked. So the thing with the compact is that even if we have the right to come here to the United States, we are still deportable.
Looking ahead, what would you want the relationship between the U.S. and the Marshall Islands to look like?
I think that really is going to depend on the United States taking full responsibility for the nuclear testing. We just had our third compact negotiations not too long ago, and we were hoping for a bilateral agreement that would address many of these issues, but it came and went without any substantial changes. And, you know, that was the case in 2003 when they renegotiated the second compact. And so it's very frustrating, but, you know, we want to continue to be hopeful and continue this fight for justice.
Politok has put detailed questions to the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. In response to the question, why has the VA failed to establish any on-island healthcare services for Marshallese veterans, despite the legislation passed in 2024? They said a law passed in 2024, the Consolidated Appropriations Act, gave Veterans Affairs the option to provide direct medical care to veterans in Marshall Islands, Palau, and FSM, but it did not provide funding for that care. It went on to say it provides health care to the veterans who are eligible to access the Foreign Medical Program in COFA states, and that Veterans Affairs continues to work with the U.S. Congress to consider options for improved care for all veterans. Politok has also put detailed questions to the U.S. Embassy in Majuro. In response, the United States says it acknowledges the negative effects of its nuclear testing program in the Marshall Islands between 1946 and 1958, and says it has accepted and acted on its responsibility. The embassy pointed to the Compact of Free Association and the Section 177 agreement, saying they constitute a full settlement of all claims related to nuclear testing. It said the U.S. has provided more than $600 million to affected communities, more than $1 billion in today's terms, through compensation, resettlement, rehabilitation, and healthcare. On calls to revisit compensation, the United States says its position has not changed, that the settlement covers all claims past, present, and future. Politalk is hosted by me, Scott Whitey. Our producer is Kuntamari Crofts. Our supervising producer is Jordan Fennell. And our executive producer is Faleanga Fulu, Inga Stunzner.